Okay, I've had a lot of Ask a Basket questions, and I'm going to say that at the break, that's it. You know, I mean, no more, because I do have so much to talk about, but all the questions were really valuable. Most of them were around step 12, but I'll go to the ones that deal with steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. I thought I had these in order, but I didn't. So step 4, we say we commence to outgrow fear, but what if the fear doesn't go away? It still lingers. Do we act as if? Is our program not strong enough? Are we not, I can't quite read this, but not relying on God enough? Very good question. That's not been my experience. But it is my experience that people who work step 4 don't necessarily, if they're just starting and not familiar with this process, that they don't always know what their God would have them be, which is where you do outgrow fear. So sometimes in the step 5 process, that's where you sort of work with the person who's listening to you to figure out what would your higher power have you be in relation to this particular fear. And that's what I do when I sponsor. I mean, lots of people who are just starting off this program say, oh, they say the prayer, God, please remove my fear and direct my attention to what you would have me be. And then they say, well, I don't know what God would have me be in relation to that. So I work with them at step 5 to help them work that out. And I've rarely seen a situation where they don't get some guidance, they don't get some sense of outgoing fear. It's really always an application of the Serenity Prayer. What is it that you can do? What is it that you have to accept? I mean, it's really nothing more than that. But a person who accepts what he or she cannot change and who does what he or she can do to change whatever he or she can. And that's really what the fear prayer is all about. That's my experience. Good question. Remember I talked about in the resentment form and under selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, I said at a certain point you write ditto, ditto, ditto. And it's a good question. If you write ditto over and over, how do you get insight into your behaviors? Well, I mean, and that's a very good question. My experience is that as you look in the fourth column at each person or each principle or each institution, you will go over, okay, where have I been selfish? And you'll think about it and then say, oh, just as I was with so-and-so. It's not as if you're just going ditto, ditto, ditto. You're looking at each person and you're saying, okay, where have I been selfish? Where have I been dishonest? Where have I been self-seeking? Where have I been frightened? And in each of these questions, you will find, no doubt, that the answer is virtually the same as the answer you gave 20 pages ago. But of course, you must get insight into your behaviors by studying for each person. Okay, so that's a very good question. I didn't make that clear. Not everyone on the fourth step goes on your step 8 and 9 sheet, right? We don't make amends to all those we have resentments against, right? My answer is yes and no. And I had a good discussion over the supper dinner table last night. What amends do I owe Hitler? What harm have I done him? It's subtle, sophisticated, I suppose, in a sense to say, well, the harm I have done him is to allow him to continue to survive in my mind and to occupy my mind. I accept that most people won't see that as harm, that I've done harm to him, that he's continuing to do harm to me. And I understand that. I do understand it. For me, it makes sense, but it won't make a lot of sense to other people. And so I guess my answer is that in some cases, there will be people on your resentment list to whom you don't owe amends directly, but for whom you might find that living amends might be valuable. You're unhappy with a particular political figure, for instance. You don't know that particular figure. You know, that particular figure is doing harm in your opinion. And I'm very careful not to talk politics here. And by the way, and one thing I did want to note was that in this country, and increasingly in my country as well, but much, much less, there is a whole set of ongoing things, no matter what side of the political fence you may be in, of fear and distrust and intolerance, you know, all these things. You can't hear other people because you categorize them as not you, you know, not your thing. And this is on all sides of the fence. And this is why the steps really, and this is why principles and institutions and people should include what's going on in your life and what's going on in the life of wherever you live and wherever you find home. Because these are things, these are underlying tensions that are not related to you personally, but are related to your sense of the future or your sense of the present or your ability to live as a citizen of this country. And they should be put down, and you should be dealing with it, and you should develop a sense of tolerance, acceptance, and change, you know, whatever it is that you find through whatever your problems are. I do want to say that, but at any rate, it may be that from your perspective, it doesn't make mental sense to owe amends to a person who, in your opinion, is doing harm and all that. And I fully accept that notion. I don't do it that way. I sort of think of it as sort of, if I kick you out of my mind, if I don't think about you all the time, but I live my life in a way that tries my best to stop whatever you're doing or whatever you have done. That's the living amends. That's my amends to you. I'm not going to let you, as much as I have any power to do, I'm going to live my life in such a way that the influence that you have had or that you do have is not going to affect people over whom I have any with whom I have any contact. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's a living amends in that sense. So, I mean, for Hitler, I mean, it is what the lesson I have learned from Hitler is that I cannot stand idle when there is intolerance and hatred and, you know, things of that sort. I can't do that. It's not that I have a huge influence over many people or that I will influence anything, anyone, but I will live my life with tolerance, compassion, understanding, and standing up for what I believe in as gentle and loving a way as I can. Not angry, not, you know, but I will do it in a way that people can hear. Yeah, I mean, as a mediator, I've had this training about there are ways you can have people listen, there are ways you can't have people listen, right? And, you know, what was that Saturday Night Live skit years ago with Dan Aykroyd and Jane, just blanked her name.
Curtain.
You know, the pro and con, you know, Jane, you ignorant slut, you know that, you remember that?
Yeah.
I mean, of course, when you hear words like that, you're not going to listen to anything after that, right? So it's the loving and kindness and understanding that people who take different views from you arrive at that position from their understanding of facts and their understanding of what's going on and what's right and what's wrong. And often their understanding of what's right and what's wrong is not much different from yours, but their facts are very different from yours. And so there's no reason to get angry at people who believe in different things from you. In fact, there are ways of dealing with them. So I absolutely understand this question, and sometimes I find myself talking in a sort of a different world from most people about this. And so I really accept this notion. There are some people to whom you do not owe certainly any direct amends, but maybe the people who are on your list of resentments, who are or have committed harm, that you've had no part to play in, that it's just going on in this world, maybe the amends you owe are simply living amends that as much as you are capable of doing, you will stand up to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And it may be if you've been sexually abused or something, and the person is gone, and you have no contact, and you don't even feel, you feel a resentment, but it's no longer, well, whatever it is, whether it's traumatic or not, it may be that your living amends is to do your best to make sure that nothing like that happens to anyone else. Within your capabilities. I mean, sometimes we can't do more than donate money to a cause, you know? Sometimes we can do more. Okay? Hope that answers your question. You mentioned that we need to get out of ourselves and think about others. My experience with my own life and many OA fellows is that we have thought only of others and never or rarely of ourselves. Have you experienced this? And what do you think of this in relation to thinking about it? I covered that, I think, when I talked about amends to yourself and how it's better to think of, I mean, yeah, I've been a, you know, my language loses, you know, people walk over me all the time, you know, and that's been true, you know. One of my favorite cartoons is, I don't know if you ever heard of a cartoon character from the 20s named Casper Milk Toast, but he was the perennial loser. He was the weak person. And the classic cartoon of him, the best cartoon, I saw a collection of them, he's standing on a street corner. It's obviously a store of some kind. And it's raining, and he's crumpled and all wet. He's looking at his watch. He says, well, if he doesn't come in another half hour, he can borrow that $100 from someone else. You know? And I sort of, like, I feel I've been like that in my life. So I do understand this notion of sort of people walking over me, always doing things for others and never doing things for myself, especially the women in our program who have grown up in a society where women do so much, you know, and they're the, you know, they're the people who take care of the children, you know, they're the little women at home in this book. Not that they're always at home, but they're still, you got to be the super mom and you got to both earn the money and take care of the kids. And you feel as if you have no life yourself, and I do understand that. Yes, you deserve to have a life of your own, and that life comes from your relationship with your higher power that develops as you work the steps. And yes, you need to think of others in a way that does not harm them, and that often means saying no, where you've been saying yes all your life. And I just say that from the big book perspective, it is always getting out of yourself. Why are you doing, why are you saying no? Because you need help and I'm not helping you. You need to help yourself. You know, you need to grow up. You need to do this. You need to get out of the house. You need, you know, whatever it is. I don't know. I need time to myself because I have so many people to help that I need to refresh my own body and my own mind. And you learn to set limits and boundaries that are based not in sort of your wishes, but on your real needs. And if your needs are to help others, then your needs are to have some time to yourself and to say, this is my time. So I think of this as sort of two different sort of perspectives all arriving at the same point. That's all. But the big book is clear. It's always about others. It is. But not in the way you may have experienced and may have done it in your life. Because other people should have their own higher powers. Other people should be relating, doing things on their own. And when you help them, you harm them. Stop harming them. Don't help them. Okay? Does that make sense? I hope it makes sense. I like your God. Mine is principle, mind, soul, spirit, life, truth, and love. That's wonderful. Just want to point that out. Okay. So I've done, excuse me, step 9. I think I answered all the questions. Oh, no, I have another question here. Just a minute. Yes. When the sponsee does step 5, do you have them do the prayer with you, or is that something they only do on their step 4? Well, the prayer in step 5 is when they're alone. There's no prayer when they meet with me. So they meet with me, or meet with their, to whom they're giving their step 5, and then they go home and they pray, they thank God that you know him better. You ask if you've omitted anything. That's the alone time. That's when you're admitted to your higher power. That's when you're getting your relationship with your higher power. I think that's what the...
That's right. The question was the step 4 prayer about the sick man prayer.
Oh, the sick man prayer, well, I asked them to do it on their own. But I'll say now, but I was going to say this when I sponsor. I'll help them however I can. If they have troubles while working step 4, I'll meet with them and deal with their problems at step 4. And if they need to sort of say a prayer with me, I'll meet with them and say it with them and help them understand the effects of that prayer on where they go. Okay? I'm relatively flexible in that regard, but it is something from the big book perspective that you would be doing on your own if you can. But obviously people have their own limitations, and that's the important thing from my perspective in terms of how I sponsor. Some people have real difficulty reading this book for all kinds of reasons, not the least of which is the language. But there are many other reasons they have trouble. And some of them don't have the same education that other people have and don't understand some of the words. And some of them have less or more retention of what is said. So each person has to be sponsored individually. I don't have one set way of sponsoring other than I take them through the book. But if I ask someone to read the chapter More into Alcoholism and I meet with them, they say, boy, that was a great chapter. I love the stuff about the jaywalker, the businessman, Fred and Jim. I'm not going to read the whole chapter with them. Why should I? I'll say, okay, well, that's great. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I just want to point out certain paragraphs that really seem to me to be significant. Did those resonate with you? Let's talk about that. On the other hand, there are people with whom I have in the past, I haven't recently, sort of gone over almost inch by inch, word by word. Certainly that's how I worked with the guy when I began to my journey of recovery 25 years ago, 25 and a half years ago. We read it word for word. It was kind of boring. But the only sort of exciting parts was when we disagreed on the meaning of words and he was right and I was wrong. He with his grade 9 education, me with my Masters of English and my dictionaries, he was right, I was wrong. So that was fun, I suppose, in its own humbling sense. Okay. Can you please speak to how we make the step 8 list? Well, we have to have a sense of how we've harmed someone. And we list those people we've harmed. I talked about that a bit. Some of you may say, I owe nothing. I have not harmed this person. If you don't think you've harmed that person, don't put it down. Okay? I would highly recommend that you meet with someone before making any amends about which there is any question in your mind, or not making any amends about which there's any question in your mind. There are obvious ones, right? I mean, if you've stolen from a store, when you were a kid, you have to pay that store back. You might want to meet with someone experienced in the program to figure out how you might make that payment. If the store's gone, what do you do? I mean, all these interesting and difficult issues. But ultimately, there are some that are obvious and there's some that are not so obvious, including whether something goes on or doesn't go on your list of people you've harmed, and including whether you make the amends or whether you you would make harm. So I highly recommend you work with someone on this issue who has experience in the program. But you just make the list. Yeah, I would say go down column by column. Column 1, whom have I harmed? Column 2, what harm have I done? Column 3, what kind of amends can I make? Those are, and by the way, that sheet has a sort of a non-OA aspect to it based on the experience of a lot of people, where you also have the little check thing. Am I ready to make it now? Am I ready to make it sometime? Will I never do it? And the recommendation, the experience, it's sort of like, after you know you're going to make amends or you have to make amends, then there's a place for checking in. Am I ready to do it now? Am I ready to do it sometimes? Or will I sometimes do it? Maybe sometime. And third, I'll never be able to. And the experience of many people in this program is that you do the ones that are obvious, that you are ready to do. And when you finish that, all the things in the sometimes category will generally go over into the yes now category, and all the things in the no go into the sometimes. And then you do the ones that you're ready to make, and then the things that used to be in the no and they're now in the sometimes will turn into the ready. Because you will, every time you make an amends, the experience of millions of people is that you feel better. As difficult as it may be, you feel better. I did want to tell you a story about amends too. I've heard some workshops, AA workshops, where a person talks about, I didn't want to make amends to my father, my brother, or something like that because of what he did to me. I wrote out my amends. And I still didn't want to do it, and I met, and I said it, whether I wanted to or not. I read what I had written, and I didn't even want to, okay? And I didn't really believe in it or something. And yet it worked. That certainly isn't my experience. My experience, I'm not calling that other person down. It was a wonderful workshop that I listened to. But my own experience is that you have to understand where you've harmed someone, and it's only within that. And it's from that your heart is saying, I've got to make up for it. And when that's the case and you meditate about what it is that you should say, you don't write anything out. You speak from your heart. And my experience, this is an interesting story, which I think I have time to tell. My wife and I and our younger kids we were in a house that we just spent a lot of time and money on to sort of make really good. And I just joined OA. I'd been in OA for 6, 7 months. I don't quite remember. And my wife suddenly announced she found a house she wanted to buy. We've been in this house for 10 years. And it was a house that was half the size of the house we had, but was on an incredibly beautiful piece of property and was more expensive. And I started to just get so angry. And we had to make a decision soon because the house was on the market and all that. And I got so angry at my wife. And I realized this was sick. I can't get angry. If I get angry, you know. So I said, I'm going to, at that time we had only AA literature, but I said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. If you put the kids to sleep, stay upstairs. I'm going to stay downstairs. I'm going to read every piece of literature that I have, study it, think about it, and I'll tell you what I think in the morning. And I did. And actually, that was the first time I really studied the AA 12 and 12. I'm a fast reader, but you know the Woody Allen. I maybe should mention his name. But the joke that a comedian said was, I took the speed reading course and I was able to read War and Peace in a half an hour. It's about Russia. You know, but I really did enjoy I really read the AA 12 and 12. It has a lot of stuff about financial insecurity and stuff. It's a wonderful book because it was written at a time that Bill was experiencing clinical depression, and so he was working on getting out of this clinical depression. So there's a lot of really wonderful, meaty stuff in there about being useful and what financial security means and stuff like that. It's a wonderful book. And I read, and I prayed that, even though I didn't believe in anything, I prayed that in the morning I would come to an understanding. I go to bed, my wife's asleep, I go to bed, I wake up in the morning, and my wife is looking at me. I said, oh, my God. I didn't quite expect it to be so sudden. And out of my mouth came words that I had no idea were in me. I said, I don't know whether we can afford this. I don't know whether it's what our house would sell for and that. I don't know whether this is the right house for us, and I want to talk about that with you. But I want to give you a promise. Whatever decision we make will be our decision and not my decision. And not your decision. I will never blame you for, if we buy the house, I will not blame you for it. And she cried, which obviously meant that I had said the right thing, even though I had no idea. So my first experience is how if it comes from the heart, it's the right thing to say. And when we get to step 11, and I talk about intuition, that the big book promises us, that we will have this intuitive ability to know things. That's one of the promises, actually, that we read, right? We'll have the intuitive ability. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. That's the ultimate promise. That's the promise that keeps on giving. I mean, you begin not to analyze situations, but just to, because the pipeline's there. You know, the pipeline is open. So whatever's in your heart, your higher power, is coming into your mind, and you're thinking and saying and acting consonant with that, generally speaking. You learn to rely on that, as step 11 says.
Did you buy that house?
It's a longer story, and it's a little shameful story. It's another lesson in there. I shared at my next OA meeting what had happened, and a woman, a good friend of mine, passed away now, came up to me and said, "Oh, Laurie, I really appreciate what you said. You know, I'm on welfare, and you know, a week ago I ran out of money, and I prayed about it, and someone just phoned me the next day and offered to buy some of my paintings or my knitting. I can't remember what it was. So I really understand what you're saying about fear of financial security." I felt so humble. I felt, my God, I told a story that a woman who didn't have food understood when I'm talking about moving from one expensive house to another expensive house. And I just felt so amazed. Anyway, we did buy the house. 10 years later, my wife and I are in a car, we're driving on a highway, and I start to blame her for buying that house. And this was after I had recovered. This is while I was absent. This is why I was Mr. Big Book, you know. And I started, and for 10 minutes, I got it. This is why we shouldn't have bought it. This is financial insecurity. I feel as if I'm working for the house, not for... And then I suddenly realized that I'd just broken one of the most important promises I'd ever made to my wife. It's still taken me a long time to overcome that. As a matter of fact, we ultimately sold that house and moved into a smaller place just recently, and a condo. And while we were selling the house, I said to her, I want you to know that this has been a really good house, and I think that we made the right decision. And she said, well, you never told me that. You know, and all the resentment from that time that, I mean, obviously things had festered, so there was probably other times. So I want you to understand, I am not a perfect person. And I practice this program good enough, but I am not, I don't have a spirituality at times, and I had got to work for it. And so anyway, that's the whole story. And it was a wonderful house. And I really, after that tirade, after I tried to make amends, I accepted that house in a way that I hadn't before. And it was wonderful. And it was a great place for our kids to grow up. And it was just a terrific place. Okay. What about making amends to grown children who may or may not remember your recklessness, regrets from their early childhood, or things they do remember and have issues about? Well, those are two different issues. Let's take the ones they don't remember. I would be very careful of reminding people of specific things that you did to them for fear of awakening whatever trauma that might have happened. You know, I didn't treat you well, or I don't think I was as good a mother or father as I could have been, or something like that. I'm willing to discuss anything that you may want to bring up and anything you may have a resentment, and talk about that with you and apologize to you for that. So you sort of open the door for them to talk to you, but, you know, there's really no need. And sometimes they'll say, you know, I mean, I've seen this happen, a few days later, you didn't bring up X, and you should have brought up X. And you can say, I didn't want to bring up memories that I wasn't sure you had, and I didn't want to bring up anything that was awful. I remember that. I am so sorry for that. And that's the best you can do. You can't do anything more. Okay, you know, I have this on stun, and it's making me crazy because it's just beeping all the time. It's not beeping, but okay, fine. Okay, now, we're on to step 10, which is, for me, the most important step, because it's the one that I misunderstood. It's not the most important. Step 12 is the most important step, but this is the one that stood between me and relapse, has stood between me and relapse for the last almost 25 years. Step 10 comes in between the well-known promises and the hidden promises. And let's read it, because remember, on the wall, as written as we read it at meetings, is, you know, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Now, first of all, I hope I have shown you that it's valuable to look at the inventory process, as being steps 4 through 9 and not just step 4, even though in the steps as they're written, it's only mentioned in step 4. Because if you recall, I've pointed out the Big Book says a commercial inventory is a fact-finding, process. It is designed, one of the objects is to identify and to be rid of the things that are blocking you. So you identify them in steps 4 and 5. You're ready to get rid of them, and you ask your higher power to get rid of them in 6 and 7. But it's 8 and 9 where you get rid of them by becoming a different person, by saying, I have done wrong. I want to clean up the past so I can live my life differently from the way I've lived it. So from the Big Book perspective, I think it's fair to say that the inventory process, it must grate on some of you to hear process. It's process. I know. But it's Canadian. Canadians. Anyway, it's English. Well, it's the English way of saying it. Canadians have vestiges of the English colonial times. I don't say about. I say about. So, where the hell was? So that's valuable to see, because in step 10 it says continue to take personal inventory. That's not just step 4, it's steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. Next, continue to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, promptly admit it. And I think I gave you the example on Friday. There was a time, like my first year in OA was sort of accepting happiness, this is my Jewish guilt. I was happy, everything was going well, and I had to learn how to accept being happy. I felt it was wrong being happy while other people were unhappy. But then things began to happen, especially in my wife's life, that were really sad. Her father died quickly. When he died, we discovered that he had been protecting my mother-in-law, because she had Alzheimer's, and we didn't know that. We would only see her in relatively lucid times, and we realized here's another whole aspect of responsibility. Her sister was quite ill, and ultimately 6 months later died of cancer. And yet her sister continued to try to take care of her mother. So my wife was taking care of both her sister and her mother, and I loved them all. I mean, I can't tell you how wonderful all three of those people were. So my wife was spending a lot of time with them, and I was resenting the time that she was spending with them and feeling guilty that I was resenting the time that she was spending, because I knew she should be spending that time. And I would yell at my kids. But I didn't deal with this new stuff in my life, because I thought it's when I did something wrong, I would apologize for it. Well, I didn't take it on my wife. I may have, I don't remember. I didn't take it on my sister-in-law or my mother-in-law. I took it on my kids. I didn't hurt them. I would yell at them at various times. They do something slightly annoying, which I would have laughed at when I was happier, but which I yelled at it. And I'd say, oh, I'm sorry I yelled. And I thought, that's step 10. And I relapsed. Eventually, I relapsed. For all kinds of reasons, but that was that was one of the main reasons. And it wasn't until I started to study the Big Book 7 years later, because that would always happen to me. I'd relapse, I'd go back to my sponsor, or my sponsor left, I'd go to get a new sponsor, I'd work the steps, I would go to 3 meals a day, nothing in between, not eat anything that's fat or that's, I didn't, not eat anything that's fattening. I was on sort of like a diet. But it was a good diet, and it met my needs. I would work the steps. I'd do step 4 and 5. I'd deal with the issues. I'd feel, 6, 7, 8, and 9. I didn't have many direct amends to make, but a lot of living amends. I made, I was doing that. I was flying high. Other things would happen. I'd yell at my kids, or I'd do something. I'd apologize. I'd relapse. And this happened over a 7-year period. And then I started studying the Big Book, and I started listening to the to tapes by Blaine. And I still remember where I was. I was driving a car sort of north of my hometown to a kind of a resort hotel where a whole bunch of families were meeting over after Christmas with all of our younger kids. And I heard this guy say, step 10 is step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. Done in the context of recovery. So you've recovered, so you aren't doing steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, because 9 gives you recovery. That's the promises I read last night. But you still have to continue to clean up the past that has occurred between the time you last finished your amends and today. So if I last did a step 5 on January the 1st, 2018, that's step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 on January the 1st, 2018. It's now April the whatever it is. Whatever. And things have happened to me. Lots of things have happened to me, actually, in the last little while. I told some of you, my father died a week ago or a week and a couple days ago at the age of 101. Still had his mind. Peacefully at home. No pain. Ready to die and ready to accept death. Met his granddaughter, named after my late mother. My granddaughter, his great-granddaughter, had a great relationship with his grandsons. He had a life. It was a great life. I told him, I'll never mourn you, but I will miss you. I miss him tremendously, but I don't mourn him. I mean, his life was one to be celebrated. So anyway, so that's happened. I will probably someday put that onto a step 10. So I want to read the one paragraph dealing with it. It's something that Bill put into the big book, put into the steps. It wasn't one of the original six steps, but it was something that people took for granted in the Oxford groups and within the groups of OA. It's one paragraph because the directions are already there from steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. So if we look at page 84, this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. Even that's different from and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Continue to set right is a much more direct action step than admitting it, right? We vigorously commence this way of living as we clean up the past. That's steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. We have entered, it's happened, the world of the spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. I admit that the word resentment is there and the word self-seeking isn't, but that's step 4. When these crop up, we ask God who wants to remove them, steps 6 and 7. We discuss them with someone immediately, step 5. And make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone, steps 8 and 9. And then it says, then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our core. So I think you can see that in that short paragraph is what we did in steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And I can only tell you that every problem I've ever had has been resolved through steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, or as I would say, step 10. I was just talking to some people, I'm not losing weight. Someone else says, I don't like this meeting that I go to. Someone else has written, it may be one of the things, meetings no longer mean anything to me. I find the meetings boring. I don't have any passion anymore. I don't know whether I should change my job. I don't know whether I should do this. Those are all resentments. Those are all things that are in your mind that are confusing you. Who knows what lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows.
Yeah.
The shadow has the ability to, what was it this shadow could do to just do something to men's minds, like put a haze over men's minds. Anyway, that's what all these resentments do, as we proved in step 4. So if I don't know what to do about a particular issue, I, for instance, was going through a time when I was very unhappy with being a lawyer and doing the law I did. And I would just say, I'd put it right down my career. And I'd work through why? Well, it's not completely fulfilling. A lot of things I do are pretty neutral in what I'm doing. I forgot what else I would put, but I put down sort of things that I didn't like about my job. I go through how does this affect me, a lot of check marks. Where am I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened? First time I did this, I came up with selfish. I want my job to be 100% fulfilling. Dishonest? Who has the right? And how many people have the kind of job I have? I have a job that's at least somewhat fulfilling, and I don't do any harm, and I do some good. And I'm flexible, and I have time for my OA stuff, and I have time to be with my family. So the dishonesty was, this is a better job than most people have. Self-seeking, I deserve to have a 100% fulfilling, fulfilling job, and fear that I'll continue to feel this way. So my first aspect of dealing with this was I would just accept my job and I'd be happy with it for quite some time. Then after a while, I'd get upset. It would get to me again because maybe I had a particularly bad case or something like that. So I'd do it again. And for quite some time, I was just accepting the job. Then I got some other opportunities to do things that weren't legal. They were mediating, helping people understand each other in difficult, tense relationships. And I did a pretty good job of that. And I got a little bit more doing that. And so I said, here's another thing I can do. I did a step 10 on that. And I realized I'll never be able to get into that business without A, getting rid of all the work I'm doing right now and just giving it up completely for reasons which are not important, and B, without some certificate, without some training, you know? So I said, I'm going to take the training. That can't hurt me. I took a lot of training, took it very quickly. I got a certificate in mediation. And then I started to explore giving up all the work I had done, all the legal work I had done, and just doing mediation. And I did about 5 step 10s on that issue. And I did 3 or 4 different, I did a number of step fives with different people. I had a friend who's a career counselor and a psychologist. I had a mentor who lives in Arizona, an OA mentor. I had my wife. I did one with my wife because any decision I made that would affect our financial security, she was retired by that time. You know, I was earning money. She would have to share in, so I did it with her. So I finally, it took about 2 years or 3 years, I finally made that decision, knowing that I was taking a big risk, financial risk. And I'll tell you, it was a difficult, I did it. I left my complete career behind me, set out in this world, and I wasn't making a lot of money. And I wasn't getting a lot of work. I was getting some, but not a lot, not as much as people told me I'd get. You know, oh, I'd hire you any day, you know, oh, great. I'm available. I've got nothing for you. You know? And I had to do a bunch of step 10s on this feeling of maybe I'm not worth anything. Maybe I'm not as good as people told me I was. Maybe I don't have as much abilities. You know, I had to work on that. You know, so step 10s were dealing with me my entire life. There was a time when I was sort of like really static in my weight and it wasn't quite what I wanted to be. I did a step 10 on that. I've sometimes said, I don't know whether to give up X as a food. That's a principle. That's a resentment. You know? So every time people, like I have sponsees, and I'll talk about how I handle sponsees, but once they get through step 9 and they've recovered, my general approach to them is, well, what are you talking to me for? You know, go out and talk to someone who needs you. And this is very different. I mean, this is really provocative to a lot of people because they're so used to having this major relationship with a sponsor. I say, phone me if you need any experience on how to, or I'll meet with you, an experience that I might have about how to work with a sponsee, because I do have a lot of experience in that. Maybe I can help you if you're having problems working with a sponsee. And if you want to do the step 5 part of the step 10 to keep you, I emphasize how important step 10 is. And I say to them, I want to tell you that if you phone me with a problem, my answer will be, do a step 10 on the issue because I don't know what the answer is for you. I know what the answer would be for me, but not for you. It's your higher power, your relationship with your higher power that's much more important than your relationship with me. And to talk with me is, it may be comfortable, but you really should be talking to that person who's sitting by herself, whom no one's talking to. You know, sure, I keep in contact with people. I mean, sure, I see them at meetings. Or there are a couple people who don't live in Winnipeg with whom I have a pretty regular phone call, you know, sometimes once a week or once every 2 weeks. And they're OA members, and they might say that I'm their sponsor, and I might say that they're my sponsor. But we don't, I would say that that's just time we have to talk about the state of OA and to talk about what's going on in our lives. But really, it's step 10 that deals with this inner turmoil. It's step 10 that deals with any problems. Now that you've already done steps 4 through 9, step 10, you were an amateur, you're now a professional. And you can do things with step 10 that I would never recommend to do with step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. So I'll just give you examples. One is, if you have a particular person who's really, really bothering you, so that you've put that person down in step 1 and you've got 20 things in column 2, you know, point, 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 I have found it very helpful to take each one of those 20 things that bother you about that person and put them into step 1, into column 1, and then deal with each one drill them down further, drill deeper, and try to figure out what's going on with each one of them. Those of you who are not at this point, don't listen. It's not worth it. I'm just saying, those of you who have done this, I have found that to be very helpful.
Like redo step four in a smaller version?
No, it's a bigger version. So, for instance, if it did happen that I was having real difficulties talking to my wife, and I put my wife down, and then I wrote down 20 things that were bothering me about our relationship, you know, ranging from lack of communication to I'm worried that we might divorce because we seem so far apart, even though we do love each other, did love each other. I moved each one of those 20 into boxes in column one. So I would write down in column one, I'm worried because my wife and I are not communicating. And then I had column two ready. Why am I worried about that? Well, we don't seem to be talking. There seems to be something in the air that we aren't dealing with. I'm afraid that this will get worse. So those are maybe the 3 points under that one thing. So I was getting deeper about each one of those things in column two. Okay, I hope that makes sense. And then I go through them for each principle. Where am I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened about worrying about the issue relating to communication, the issue relating to divorce, the issue relating to this or the issue relating to that. Does that make sense? Okay. That helped. I actually have done step fives with my wife. When she was on it. Because as I went to my step four, I realized that I was so much at fault in the things that I was blaming her for, that I thought that my step five should be, in effect, my amends as well. So I did the step five with her. It was only she was on that list at that point.
Can I ask a question? I'm confused with step five and step 10.
Step five, part of step 10. Okay? There's step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. You do that to recover. Then you've got step 10, which consists of five parts. The equivalent of step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. Or 5 parts. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 6 parts. Okay? So when I say the step 5 part of step 10, it's just that imagine step 10 as being steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 done in the context of recovery.
But you're using the same
forms. I use the same forms. Yeah. I'm sorry. I use the same forms. I do the same things as I did. Exactly the same things that I did, except I know the forms so well that I just use blank pieces of paper. And I don't have to ask myself, am I delighted? Can I look the world in the eye? Can I be alone in perfect peace and ease? Because really, by the time I finish writing step four, I know exactly where I am. Oh, God, not this again. You know, I remember dealing with this before. Because life goes on, and especially if you have a close relationship with a bunch of people, and they age, and you have, you know, and the relationships change, it's still about the same as life goes on. step five. I will sometimes do a step five with the last recovered person at a meeting that I go to. Can you give me 5 minutes? You know, just because I have to do it, not because I need to do it, because I know perfectly well what I'm sharing. Excuse me. 6 and 7, they go like a flash. Of course I'm ready, you know. 8 and 9, I write it out, living amends, almost always living amends. You know, so it's really fast. I mean, sometimes it can take less than half an hour, 45 minutes. And just and now that I'm mostly retired and my wife is retired and we're living in this sort of smaller space, she's often my step five person because she's hardly ever on it. how often do you do a step 10? And here's where big book thumpers have difficulties, have disagreements. Ruth, the Vision for You special speaker, says you do it every night. In my opinion, we'll get to step 11 in a moment, I think that's bringing together two different things. There's a step 11 evening meditation, which looks a lot like step 10, but I think there are differences. I respectfully disagree with her because obviously it works for her. And who am I to say that her interpretation is wrong? It's just not my interpretation. Harlan, another special speaker, says you do them three, four times a day. Well, obviously it's slightly different what he's imagining than from what I imagine. Both Ruth and Harlan use forms that are different from the ones that I use. Their forms are more derived from Joe and Charlie, which bring in other aspects than just the big book. But I do them whenever I am restless, irritable, or discontented. That's from the doctor's opinion. I do them whenever, excuse me, I've forgotten the page number. Whenever I am having trouble with personal relationships, whenever I can't control my emotional nature, whenever I'm a prey to misery and depression, Whatever I can't make a living, whatever I have a feeling of uselessness, or I'm full of fear, or I'm unhappy, or I can't seem to be of real help to other people. That's the bedevilments found on page 52. There were eight of those, three of restless, irritable, and discontented. Surprise, I have one more, so I got 12. Don't know why I wanted 12, but I got 12. And the last one is, whenever food becomes an issue, if I'm gaining some weight, I weigh myself usually once a month. I don't weigh and measure my food. I rely on sort of my intuition as to whether I'm eating too much or too little of the foods I can eat. So sometimes I begin to gain a little weight. Well, that means that somehow my mind isn't doing a good job of being conscious of how full I am. So clearly I have to clean my mind up. That has sometimes happened to me, but not that often, usually, because I think that's the bottom line. Or if food becomes tempting, once, it's amazing. I don't remember it ever happening but once. It probably has happened more than once, but once in the last 25 years, something looked tempting to me. And I thought, I should try it. And the fascinating thing was, it was in some restaurant where the three people I was with had ordered the same dish plus these sweet potato fries. Not one of them ate the fries after trying one of them. Clearly, they weren't good. And I was saying, well, they're sweet potatoes. They're not potatoes. It's not really French fries. You know, they're going to waste. I thought, oh, my God, I should be doing a step 10, you know. Whereas I should have noticed maybe 2 months earlier that I was restless, irritable, and discontented, you know. So I do them whenever I feel restless, irritable, and discontented, whenever things are not going my way, or I'm feeling that things aren't going my way. That's when I do them. Sometimes that means once a week, and sometimes that means once a year, depending on what's going on in my life and how I'm pursuing other spiritual paths. I'll get a little bit more into that when I get to step 11 to give you a really good distinction between step 11 and step 10. Okay, page 85. So I'm going to say about step 10, except my experiences with my sponsees that when they relapse, if they relapse, the biggest problem is, the biggest reason is that they have not done step 10. That they allow themselves to continue to be restless, irritable, discontented. They haven't been cleaning up their lives, and then suddenly things explode. Okay, big book, page 85. It's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We're headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve. A reprieve is a suspension of a death sentence. So we have a daily suspension of a death sentence. Contingent, requiring the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Okay? So remember, half measures avail us nothing, 9/12 measures avail us nothing. You can't just stop at step 9. Can't rest on how wonderful everything is today. You've got to keep growing in your spiritual life. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. That's the step 10 prayer, I think. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. Remember we talked, we in step 3, we turn our will and our lives over the care of God as we understood them. We get our will back. Well, how do we get our will back, or why? Because it's in tune with our higher power. And everything we want to do is what our higher power wants. Because we've got this pipeline cleared. So we have our will back. Even though we turn it over, we get it back. But our will is now, what is my higher power? What is my higher power want?
Lori, did you say that this was step 10?
I have that written down. Someone once said to me.
No,
that's a step 10 prayer. Every day is a day we must carry. You make it a step 11 prayer. Sure. I don't care. I have it written down step 10. I'll write it down as step 11. Thank you. Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from him who has all knowledge and power. Again, as a skeptical agnostic, I don't like reading words like that, but what the hell? If we have carefully followed directions, we've begun to sense the sense of the flow of his spirit into us. To some extent, we've become God conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense, but we must go further, and that means more action. I just want to say that the sixth sense, Bill talks about being in the fourth dimension of existence in his story, And that's the sixth sense. That is the sense that the pipeline is open and that our higher power, whatever that means to you, our higher power is streaming directions to us. And we're in tune with them and we're feeling them and we're acting. And thus we can afford to act on our intuition rather than analyze it. And step 11 talks about that much more clearly. So that's the sixth sense. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. Prayer is asking, meditation is listening. We shouldn't be shy in this matter. If prayer, better men than we are using it constantly, page 86 now. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. Now, we're about to hear the big book's discussion of prayer and meditation. It's so different from what the word meditation means to most people today. All of what meditation means today is wonderful stuff. The chanting of mantras, the being alone in a room, the candle, the sitting in the lotus position, I want you to know I don't call that down. I have at times practiced those things. The sort of cleansing your mind. I mean, all the meditative principles that we know about, mindfulness, all these things, they're so valuable to so many people. But the big book is not about that. The big book has a minimum you can add to it. One of my good, close friends and mentors in this program spends an hour a day meditating. And I spend 5 minutes, maybe 10, if I do it. Sometimes I do it subconsciously, not as consciously as I should. But the big books are, this book is very, very practical. It's oriented to being a better person and acting better and not to communing. And I just want to point this out as we go through it. You'll see the big book's approach. So the big book says, when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. In the manuscript, the original manuscript, it said, when you wake tomorrow morning, look back over the day before. And someone must have said, Bill, why don't we do it at night? You know? So that's why it's the beginning, when we retire at night. So you retire at night. And here are the questions. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? That's step four again, right? We heard that it's an echo of what was in step 10. Have we kept something? Do we owe an apology? Steps 8 and 9. Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Step 5. Were we kind and loving towards all? What could we have done better? I'm just going to stop for a moment. The question at night is you're reviewing the day, just the day. And the questions are asked, were you resentful? Whereas in step 10, it was continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty. Okay, there's a difference, even in the wording. Do we owe an apology? Maybe you don't. Maybe the answer is no. Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? If the answer is no, there's no step 5 in your future that day, right? So these I see as qualitatively different. And then they go on. Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. I see this as a daily meditation in which I review the day that has just passed. And I ask these questions. I don't always ask them. I'm not, as I said, I'm not your poster boy. I'm here to give you what I've been taught, but don't think that I'm an icon of this program. I'm not. And I think of that as sort of a daily practice in which I'm reviewing what I did today so I can do a better job tomorrow. Not step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, using, pieces of paper, making an appointment, sharing with another human being, actively thinking, well, God, these are my defects of character. Here's where I've been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened in my life. In everything that's gone on since my last step 9 or step 10, I see them as different. And I'll give you this example. There, 24 or 5 years ago, my mother suffered a stroke that rendered her unable to speak more than 3 or 4 words at a time. And up until that time, she was one of the most, I don't know how to put it, she could walk into a room and get everyone talking. She was able to just brighten up a room, and at her memorial service, I mean, people talked about her ability to do that. I've seen her go to a party where no one knew anyone else, and within a half an hour, they were all talking to each other happily. And they didn't even know she was there, but that was her ability. She was an amazing person. And so she suffered the stroke. She ended up being confined to a wheelchair. And she was so unhappy with her life, so unhappy. That was hard to see, you know? So every night, I made sure to have contact with her and my father. They were living in the house that I'd grown up in. I no longer was. And I had contact with her and with him every day. Now, with her, the contact was difficult because she could hardly say anything. And over the phone, but I would visit them as often as I could. And every day, I would think to myself, and I did do this, how have I treated my parents? Is there something I can do better? How am I going to do something tomorrow? You know, did I treat them with love? Did I think of them? But every week, I would put down on a step four form, as part of my step 10, my mother, my father, their relationship, and anything else that was bothering me for that week. And I would go through that, and I discover things about my mother. Like my mother, I wouldn't have discovered this doing the evening meditation, but I want her back. I want my mother back, my mother back. You know, I don't want her to suffer. And then as I continue to write things, I'm worried that Dad will die before she does because he's older and he's actively taking part in her care and lifting her and stuff like that. I don't want to change her diapers. You know, and so, I mean, you can see where I'm going. I mean, it's all these things, they would not show up in an evening meditation as to how well I was doing that night, how well I did that day. My father, same thing. I don't want him to die before me. Before my mother, not in our side. I don't want to. I'm worried about his physical condition. I'm worried that he's going to resent all that he's doing. And then under their relationship, I mean, they were so much in love. I'm worried they'll fall out of love with each other because they're getting on each other's nerves. Now, these are not, and I would do that almost every week. The same things would come down because the same thing would happen in that week. You know, you know what I'm saying? Like, so. For me, the step 10s were freeing and the step 11s were practical. That's how I see the difference. Now, I tell you very clearly, not everyone sees that difference. Many big book thumpers, and not just Ruth and Harlan, but including Blaine, the guy who taught me so much, will say that step 10 and step 11 evening prayer are the same. And if you have the time to write down in step four on the forms and then have someone you can talk to every night and then, you know, pray to have God remove your defects of character, 6 and 7, and then figure out what amends you have to make, God bless you. I don't have that time and I don't do it, okay? And I find that the perspective I get from doing step 10s, not every day, and sort of reviewing the entire life, I find that to be very helpful to me. But again, I'm not trying to tell you that I'm right. I'm just telling you what I feel. There are lots of people whom I respect who disagree with me. Okay? So that's what we do at night. Very practical. You know, it's not sort of praying for, you know, God to come and talk to me or anything like that. It's just, how did I do? What can I do better? Very practical. In the morning. And by the way, in the book, what page it is Blaine's wonderful bringing together of all the step 11, it's page 659, all the step 11 prayers. It's a wonderful book, a wonderful page.
59.
On awakening, now we're getting up in the morning, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking. This is the prayer. God, please direct my thinking. I especially ask that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Then they say, under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. So you're planning your day, right? So, okay, but there may be problems. You don't know what you're going to do on a particular issue. As a lawyer, I had a lot of cases, and I would say, well, I don't know what I'm going to say in the cross-examination of so-and-so, or I don't know which witness to put first, or something like that. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here are the prayers that they suggest for that. Here we ask God for inspiration and intuitive thought or a decision. And then we relax and take it easy. That has saved me so much work. You know, I know the case well. I don't know what the one cross-examination question I'm going to ask that's just going to blow this witness apart. And yeah, I did it, you know, or what's that Far Side cartoon, the cow gets up in the middle of the courtroom and says, you didn't think it would be the cow, but it was the cow. You know, that great cross-examination question. Well, when I just say, I don't know what, you know, please give me an intuition, an inspiration, intuitive thought, or a decision, and then I relax. And then I go to the hearing, it's time for me to cross-examine. I begin to realize a couple of things. One is, there isn't just one good cross-examination first question. There may be 20. The other is, the first one may not be very good, but the second one may be good. And suddenly, I'm thinking about the case, what I can bring to the case, and I'm not thinking about whether I look good or whether I, you know, and the cases went much better, and I didn't stay up all night thinking, well, if he says this, I'll say this, and all that stuff that I used to do. So it's been wonderful. What am I going to say to my boss? What am I going to say to, you know, my wife? Or how am I going to handle this issue? If you're in tune, if you've got your higher power connection, if there's not much blockage, you can learn to rely on these prayers. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We're often surprised how the right answers come after we've tried this for a while. And they give you a bit of warning. What used to be a hunch, they tell you on 87, what used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it's not probable we're going to be inspired at all times. This is at the beginning. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, here's this huge promise. We find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely on it. And this ability to feel that your initial reaction is actually the right reaction, or one of the right reactions, because you're in tune with your higher power, is truly energy efficient and truly inspirational. It is amazing. We usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. God, please show me all through the day what my next step is to be. I ask that I be given whatever I need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will. God, I ask especially for freedom from self-will. And are careful to make no request for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. In a case, if I have a case the next day, I don't ask that I win. I don't ask that my client wins, but my higher power, one of my higher power is justice. I ask that justice be done. Very different. Focuses me on my higher power, not on me personally or any of my issues. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that. It doesn't work. You can easily see why. If circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. My wife and I have sort of different waking hours. It's never worked. If we belong to a religious denomination, which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend to that also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we've been discussing. I will very often use the Step 3 prayer, the Step 7 prayer. I like the St. Francis prayer, the God make me an instrument of your peace. I use a different translation from the one that's in the big book, but in the AA 12 and 12, but it's a wonderful prayer, most of it. There are many helpful books. Also, suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. That's, 5 minutes at night, 5-10 minutes in the morning, right? From the big book perspective. And you see how practically oriented. It's not sort of, give me communion. It is, how am I going to get through this day and be useful to others? And then there are the daily meditations. As we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. If I'm agitated or doubtful, God, please give me the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, thy will be done. And I can tell you, in some of the cases I used to do, I haven't been a lawyer for a long time, I haven't acted as a lawyer for a long time, but I was up against one particular really good, but quite annoying lawyer. And there were times when I'd sort of, during a break, I'd say, I'm no longer running this show. I'm no longer running this show. I'm no longer. Thy will not mine be done. Thy will not mine be done. And within 2 minutes, right. I'm no longer running this show. Thy will not mine be done. And I'm calm. You know, I mean, it really is quite amazing. It's a mantra. That's what it is. It's just a mantra that is in accordance with the wording of the big book. That's all. And the promise is here. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. Look at this promise. It works. It really does. We alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in the simple way we've just outlined. Boy, it'd be nice to stop there. I'd have a lot more time if we could. But this is not all. There is action and more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. When is the break scheduled for? 10:30. Yeah. Okay, so I have some time, and I'm going to take this time to do the chapter Working with Others and to answer. There are a whole bunch of ask-a-basket questions. Then we'll break at 10:30. We'll come back at 10:45, and we finish at 11:30, right? Yeah. I have a note. I think it was Blaine who said this. You have to live your life beyond reproach. You may be the only copy of the big book someone ever sees. I'm going to cover more than just this chapter because I want to talk about the state of OA. I want to talk about sponsoring in general. I want to talk about a group that I used to be part of, a secret group within OA called the Traditions Police, and things like that. And I want to talk about how to make a meeting better. I want to talk about the growth of OA or the lack of growth of OA and things of that sort. But let's start with the big book, and then I want to talk a little bit about AA history. Practical experience shows, so this is page 89. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Here are some step 12 promises. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover. To see them help others. To watch loneliness vanish. To see a fellowship grow up about you. To have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. If you turn to page 180, this is Dr. Bob's nightmare, Dr. Bob's story, Dr. Bob the saint. Right at the bottom, he says, I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learned to others who want and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. One, page 181, sense of duty. Two, it is a pleasure. Three, because in so doing, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. One man, Bill Wilson. That's his debt. How many debts do I owe to how many people? Starting with Bill Wilson. Or maybe starting with Eddie, for all I know. And then going on and on to all the mentors I've had in this program, all the sponsors I've had, all the people who've given me the time, all the people to whom I owe my 25 years of abstinence and whom I owe being abstinent to, in the sense that I feel a responsibility. If I have a workshop coming up, I'd better be abstinent for it. You know, I don't want to cancel it. And then because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip.